Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 23rd of March, 2022, and this is Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, and I'm joined, as usual, by our online news editor, Phil Bishop, to discuss some of the most recent happenings in the UK construction industry. What's been going on, Phil?
Well, the sun has got his hat on. Hip, 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 hooray! All good. Nice, yes, mini March heatwave, which reminds me very much of how it was exactly 2 years ago when the first lockdown came along, and we were, those of us at the garden, at least had the consolation of nice weather to sit out in when we weren't allowed to do anything else.
That's true. It's all changed since then, though.
Yes, but we've still got nice weather.
We should get down to business.
Yes.
Talk about British, UK construction. You've got a sort of a follow-up to a story we mentioned. Was it last week or the week before about Kia's...
This is a report back in January. We take no credit for this at all. The only people who've been reporting this one way or another is one particular journalist from Sky News, who in January had got some inside source, presumably a sort of city advisor type, had told him that Kia was in talks to buy Tilbury Douglas. And neither Kier nor Tilbury Douglas would comment on this. But the fact that they didn't poo-poo it suggests that it was probably there was something going on. And that was in January. And he's now reported the other day that it's not happening after all, folks. Kier has walked away, apparently, from these unconfirmed talks. They mentioned, the Sky News chap mentioned, a price of $50 million was being talked about. But he admitted that he had no idea why talks had broken down. I can tell you why talks have broken down. It's because Andrew Davies of Kier is not a blooming lunatic, frankly.
I think as you said at the time, it didn't seem to make any sense at all that Kier would want to embark on such a venture. I mean, they've been stung too many times in the past, haven't they?
Yes, and there are, as I understand it, and again, no one is confirming this either way. Tilbury Douglas, you have to remember, is the rump, the only thing that's left of the whole Interserve group, which is now in, I think it's actually finally in receivership. And they've sold off all sorts of the other bits, the outsourcing and the RMD Quickform bit. And I'm not entirely sure what financial nasties and liabilities, whether we're talking about pension liabilities and other such things, are left behind on Tilbury Douglas's balance sheet. So I've a hunch that Tilbury Douglas's accounts might not be as straightforward as another equivalent sort of company's accounts might be. So it might be going through the books. It's kind of like, oh, there's some unknowns here. Even allowing for the fact that Tilbury Douglas is a loss-making business, which overlaps heavily with Kier. And it doesn't really, I mean, there are people who make, you know, adding Tilbury Douglas would make a lot of sense and put them into a whole new ball game.
No, but not a big player like Kier. No, I wouldn't have thought so. Anyway, so it's not happening. It was never happening, no. Probably. We don't.
I said, when we talked about this in January, I said that if it made no sense and I couldn't understand why Kier were even considering it. Maybe it's just a cunning way to have a look at the books.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. So
Another thing which has been reported as an imminent event, or maybe not imminent, but an event that will happen, which has not happened and is not happening yet, we've reported on this week, is the demolition of Grenfell Tower. Clearly this is a very sensitive subject. But a year ago, a report by structural engineers from Atkins told the Ministry of Housing, and I quote, "There is unanimous agreement and unambiguous advice from all the technical experts and engineers involved in the Grenfell project that the tower should not be propped for the medium to long term, but should be deconstructed, i.e. brought down, at the earliest possible opportunity, with deconstruction beginning no later than May 2022. So we are supposed to be seeing the bringing down of Grenfell Tower starting in the next few weeks, no later than May 2022. Clearly, this is a highly sensitive topic. 72 people were killed by the fire there in June the 14th, I've got in my head. 14th of June 2017, the fifth anniversary coming up. And the Secretary of State responsible, Secretary of State for Levelling Up, Secretary Michael Gove, has written a letter to the interested parties, the victims and relatives support group, say that it's not the right time. Now is not the right time to take a decision about the future of Grenfell Tower. Essentially, they spent years engaged in talks with all the stakeholders, I guess is the word, to try and, well, politically to keep them on board, but perhaps more sympathetically to demonstrate that the government is trying to do what it can, whether it's on the cladding crisis or the more, you know, personal human rehousing people and looking after people who've been affected by the fire. So it's a tricky one. But he's saying there's still voices whose voices that we haven't heard from, and there are more people as part of this whole public engagement. We're still talking to people who want to continue that process until that process is exhausted.
But I don't understand, Phil, is why is there, maybe it's, I'm just missing the point. Why is there this sensitivity about demolishing the tower? It's got to come down sooner or later. I think everybody's agreed. I mean, I suppose in a way, I'm answering my own question. It is a reminder of what happened back in 2017. But, you know, you've got to move on. It has to come down. They've done all the, presumably, they've done all the forensic investigation that they need to do. They've had to prop it up in order to keep it standing. I just don't understand why they don't say it's got to come down. We'll take it down. You know, put a memorial there or something else. But surely they can't keep this building standing for much longer.
Oh, there's certainly going to be a memorial, and that's part of what the discussions are about. Yeah. That there's no doubt whether it'll be some form of public gardens. That would be my guess, with the names of the victims,
sure,
I guess, on a plaque as a type of thing. But no, I mean, rationally and logically, I and any person not directly involved, I think, would agree with you, David. Certainly engineers and the technical experts unanimously agree, as I said. But we're not, you know, we didn't lose our mothers, sisters, children,
no,
relatives in this fire. We didn't escape from it.
But who's saying leave it? Is anybody actually saying don't demolish it?
I don't know, to be honest.
I can't believe that there's anybody who actually wants it to remain standing. I don't quite understand Gove's reticence about it either. I think that basically he's sitting on the fence, isn't he?
Yeah, he doesn't want to be seen as a, you know, hard bastard sweeping it under the carpet.
No.
And no, I can understand his reticence at. It's not like he's the transport minister and will be probably gone tomorrow. He might be in the job for another couple of years. Might not. I mean, housing ministers don't normally stay that long. At the moment, it looks like it will be Michael Gove that will have to say, time to start bringing it down. But he's not ready to do that yet.
What he is ready to do, though, is have another stab at the house building industry, I notice. He's caused a bit of a furore here, hasn't he, amongst the major house builders.
He called them a cartel, didn't he?
He did. This was a report in, was it in the Telegraph, I think?
I'm not sure which paper, but yes, no, it was. It was the Telegraph, yes.
And he was speaking to a Conservative Environment Network. I don't know what the Conservative Environment Network is, but I got a couple of quotes here. He said he's not particularly popular with developers at the moment because of some of the steps we've taken in respect to building safety. So, you know, he's talking about the cladding business. But then he went on to say, we've essentially got a cartel of volume house builders who operate in a particular way, and there are all sorts of unhappy consequences, which instantly threw a cat amongst the pigeons. There's been a bit of a pushback, I think you could call it, hasn't there, from the major house builders?
I haven't seen it. I don't know if it's online yet, but I understand that the House Builders Federation, the cartel, allegedly, has written back to him, basically saying, "Oi, how dare you? We're not a cartel."
Because a cartel is a specific thing. It's a very precise accusation to make, isn't it?
Well, I think it has a legal definition,
yeah.
But equally, it's a term that can be used fairly loosely.
Yeah, and like a cozy relationship.
There are different ways of using it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it does have certain cartel-like characteristics, but I don't think anyone could say the house building industry is a cartel any more than you could say that the supermarkets are a cartel or car manufacturers or crane manufacturers, just because there are only half a dozen or so that dominate, well, a few more in the house builder's case, but any market or industry where you only have a few players, you need to keep an eye on them for cartel-like behaviour, but there can still be perfectly healthy, competitive behaviour.
I mean, there are some, in construction, famous cartel cases, aren't there? I mean, cement, I can remember, has been bubbling under for a long time, but there were only three cement producers, and they were stitching up the market between themselves, and I think they were at it for quite a long time. But this isn't the same, is it? I mean, whatever you think about the house building industry, and I personally don't think the house building industry is particularly healthy, the way it's structured at the moment. But I don't think it's a cartel in the same way that the cement producers were back in the, I don't know, in the 80s and 90s. This is a different sort of thing. They're still in competition. But I do agree with Gove when he seems to think that they're not playing. It's not really cricket the way they're playing at the moment.
I think context is perhaps missing here. My impression was his initial comment was talking to an environmental group. He was playing to the gallery. He was going, "I'm on your side."
Yeah.
They're the big rich, fat cat capitalist house builders, yaboo kind of thing. And equally, if he was talking to, he wouldn't talk to road builders, but if he was talking to construction companies, he'd go, "Oh, those, unwashed eco-protesters who are stopping getting things built, aren't they appalling, lefty retro people?" So I think there's an element of playing to the crowd.
You've got to look at the context in which he said that and who he was speaking to. But I haven't seen any response yet, but I imagine that the Persimmons and the Taylor Wimpeys and the rest will be pretty miffed to hear him say that.
My advice would be, don't rise. Don't dignify it with a response. I think it's treat it as a flippant throwaway comment, and get over it.
He made some remark in the same speech about. He said something like their instincts are to build on greenfield sites and gobble up greenfield sites rather than focus on regeneration. So again,
he's a bloody bum. Responsible for letting them build on greenfield sites.
Well, yeah, I know he wants to. Yeah, his reform or proposed reform of the planning regulations certainly.
Well, he's ditched that. To be fair, Gove's ditched
well,
that.
That's I know,
last,
but yeah,
last person's plan.
Yeah, okay, all right then. Yeah, fair enough.
But it's his government.
Yes, that's true. So I don't think that Michael Gove really cares about that sort of response. Actually, he likes stirring things up, doesn't he? That's what he's for.
Yes, he has a certain mysterious glint about him, doesn't he? I don't know. I mean, I say that it might have been I suspect it was a flippant throwaway line attacking the house builders, but there might be more to it than that, because the house builders or the housing developers have until the end of this month, according to a different conversation, to come up with a plan for the cladding, paying the bills for the cladding repairs. Part of this is about cladding, and the wider story is the whole fire safety retrofit thing. And the house builders initially came up with a proposal, and he said, "Nope, not good enough, go away, come back better." Mm-hmm. So there are fairly high-level negotiations / arguments going on between the housing developers and Michael Gove anyway about the whole cladding repair fund, cladding remediation funding coming to a head. So maybe there's an element of tactics there.
Yeah, it could be.
Cranking up the heat.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to move on from Michael Gove to Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Sorry. Is that an improvement?
not for me. I mean, Gove I can agree with, disagree with, whatever. Mogg, I have never in my life, I don't think, agreed with him about anything at all.
No.
Until, shock horror, last Saturday.
Ooh.
When there's a piece in The Telegraph, 19th of March, saying that as the Minister for Government Efficiency, he wants to shake up government outsourcing so that it focuses more on taxpayer value for money and less on supposedly ethical principles. Now, that ethical principles is a slightly loosely worded, but more particularly, he wants to reduce the weighting given to social value in the decision-making of awarding public contracts. Now, we've talked about social value before, and it all stems from the Public Services Brackets Social Value Close Brackets Act of 2012, which was sort of the culmination of the development of corporate social responsibility. And everyone, motherhood and apple pie thing, everyone thinks that big business should be good guys, not bad guys, and that they should do good wherever possible, and they should be training people, and they should be not polluting the atmosphere, and they should be basically not behaving like P&O ferries.
That's a convenient example, yeah, absolutely.
You know, the construction industry, by and large, said, yeah, we're good guys, we can prove that we're good guys, we'll go forward, and as large as gone forward. Anyway, so what the Act is all about is saying that local authorities not only can but must, in contrast to the old Thatcher days of contracting out where they weren't allowed to do, put in contract compliance clauses, but now they must demand of and well, they must demand that bidders for contracts specify what social good they are doing, whether that's on jobs training aspect, whether it's an environment, economy, ethical diversity issues, and all these things. And if they're going to somehow rationally decide who has the contract, they've got to have a system of measuring all of this. And so far, clients measure these things in different ways.
Mm.
And my problem, I've got all sorts of problems with this. One is it's potentially open to corruption because you can measure it how you know, if you decide you're going to, people who cycle to work, having all the workers cycle to site or walk to site, it counts for more than
how many trees you plant or
how many trees you plant or how many school visits you do.
Yeah.
There are all sorts of different things you can measure. But it would favour, you could automatically favour one company over another if that's, you know, if they're a big tree planting company or they're a big school visits or they've got a big training organisation within their company. So I don't know how you compare the different aspects. That's something that puzzles me and worries me. And equally, I also kind of think that if you're placing demands over and above building a hospital, you don't just want them to build a hospital, you also want them to do other things as well as build the hospital.
Yeah.
Then isn't that going to cost more? And is that the best use of the money? I mean, the contractor will have to put up their price, won't they? I mean, it seems to me.
Basically, we need an agreed metric for measuring social value.
There are agreed metrics, but I think there are two or three sort of different sort of ponds that people can fish in. My understanding, And maybe we'll come on to this in a bit later, it's a bit like sort of VHS and Betamax at the moment. you can do it that way, you can do it that way.
Yeah.
They're different, but they both work. And, you know, one might be better in some ways or whatever. But my fundamental problem is that I think construction is innately, it innately has social value.
Yeah.
When you build something, I mean, even if you just dig a hole and fill it in again, it's good for the worms and it keeps you fit. you know, there's value in construction, and this artificially lumping things in, it just smacks of bureaucracy to me. And the upshot, the thing that really concerns me about the whole social value issue is that the original act was designed to, the intention was to promote SMEs, small local contractors, because they thought that the company on the ground in the town, the local employees were local, and they would they were being muscled out by the big national out of towners moving in. And this would be a good way of getting helping local companies compete with the big nationals. Mm. That was the motive. All that it's done is created a social value, corporate social responsibility industry with consultants galore. And the big contractors have got their own social value teams. And the small companies cannot cope with the excess, unnecessary bureaucracy that's been generated by it all. Now, I happened to be talking to the chief executive of one of the tier one contractors yesterday, and I said, what do you think of Rees-Mogg's comments? Do you think that social value's gone too far? And chief executive tier one contractor, no, it's not gone too far at all. It's really important to compete on all metrics. And he's saying that, you know, it's very important to us that we do good things and we're seen to be doing good things. And that, you know, if we train people and, you know, recruit people from a diverse background and we seem to be good guys, it's a virtuous circle because it makes the industry more attractive and better. We get better people in, it's more efficient, new technology will come in, and we will all move forward to the bright new future together because we're doing the right thing in the right way. Now, I sort of get that. Everyone wants the construction industry to be a hero industry, to be seen to be a place for heroes to come to because we do good things. And we're not all sort of T. Dan Smith and John Poulsen out for what we can get. I've been listening to Our Friends in the North on the radio, by the way.
Oh, right, OK.
Oh, I'm loving it. It's basically the original TV, radio, TV drama, but in the radio.
But on the
format,
radio, yeah. Oh, right, OK.
But anyway.
Anyway.
The whole social thing. I accept that I am... I have more questions than answers on the whole social value thing, but I am cynical.
OK. Well, in that case, Phil, I think probably this is a good time to introduce our surprise guest. Because we actually have about to join us Andrew Lowe, who is the Chief Revenue Officer with the Social Value Portal. He's one of these consultants who will be able to explain to us what social value is and why Rees-Mogg should think twice about watering it down when it comes to procurement. So welcome to Reconstruction, Andrew. I'm glad you could join us. Maybe you can answer a few of our questions.
No problem. Thanks very much for having me on.
Phil and I have just been talking about Rees-Mogg and his comments about social value and procurement and all the rest of it. And just to let you know, I'm being good cop. Phil's being bad cop at the moment.
Right.
Well, you can't tell me how surprised I was to find myself agreeing with Rees-Mogg, because I think the social value industry has got a bit out of hand, frankly. And it's all the big guys are winning and the small guys can't cope with all the bureaucracy that's coming their way. So put me right.
Well, I can put you right quite easily, because we cater for both ends of the marketplace. You're right, it's being predominantly driven by public sector procurement, and suppliers to public sector are very often the big guys, and then their supply chain gets cascaded down. But we cater for both ends of that marketplace. We've got many bidders coming through our portal that are SMEs, and we've probably had something like 5,000 or 6,000 in the last 2 years of SMEs going through it.
Take us back, Andrew. I think you're starting halfway through. What is the social value portal? What part do you play in this industry that's emerged?
Right. So Social Value Portal is the name of our company, but it's also our platform. And it's a platform that enables customer members to upload their social value evidence. So we have employed 3 apprentices or whatever the thing is, for us to then check and validate against the National TOMS framework, which is our proprietary framework measurement.
TOMS is themes and outcome metrics or something, is it?
Themes, outcomes and measures.
And measures. Yeah.
It's become a very prominent framework that's not quite standardised across everywhere, but it seems to be winning the race as being the dominant framework in the marketplace, certainly across public sector.
I was suggesting earlier, it seems a bit like VHS and Betamax, the whole social value industry at the moment, and that we don't quite know which horse to jump on.
I think that's a fair analogy. It feels to me, without trying to be biased in any way, it feels to me that the Toms is winning the day, but it doesn't mean it's won the day at all. We're very robust in terms of how we work out our value proxies, because hiring an apprentice and its value to society in one part of the country is very different to the other. So it's a living and breathing beast for sure. But it covers a wide range of topics, from environmental to innovation to growth, etc. And it's complete. It's also free to download, free to use. There's user guides for anybody to use it, as long as they're not using it for commercial gain. In other words, they're not competing with us, if you like, but they can use it. And many local authorities are using it themselves free of charge and their supply chain. So we're not restricting it in any way.
Why hasn't the government decided on TOMS as its default sort of framework? Why hasn't it said, you have to measure your social value against TOMS criteria? Because then everybody would be on a level playing field, wouldn't they?
Well, we'd like them to, obviously, but it's our proprietary framework, so it would be to our benefit. But I think there's a frustration in the market that there are multiple frameworks. I agree, but it's a good question. It's a very good question.
How do clients measure, or how should they measure? I mean, it sounds like they can use your tool or other tools that are out there, but I don't understand the concept of saying, I'm bidding for a job and promising to take on six apprentices from the county, and someone else saying, oh, but I'll take on four apprentices from the town centre or from the district, or someone's competing on, I'll take on so many apprentices, and someone else says, well, I will do so many school visits or plant so many trees and give you a park bench and a scout hut. I mean, you're comparing apples and bicycles. I mean, it's a nonsense, surely.
Well, it's down to the percentage contribution of the project you're bidding for that you're going to contribute a social value. So there are certain social value elements that are worth more than others, and it varies from place to place depending on that place's local needs. So it could be employment, it could be environmental, it could be a multitude of different things that need supporting locally. And those things have different values to that place. It's also, if you're an SME, a challenge might be, well, you can't contribute as much social value as if you're bidding next to a big main contractor for the same piece of work. But within the project constraints itself, it's on a like-for-like basis. Most organisations, all organisations, contribute social value just by their existence. And we find new people that come on board are pleasantly surprised at how much social value they contribute just because of what they do and how they do it. It's then about continual improvement, of course, and it's then about becoming more competitive with their peers in their area for the type of work they're bidding for. And that's great. That's because that's driving the right behaviour. That's driving the improvement of social value. The single measurement at the end of it does have a pound sign against it because, you know, what gets measured gets done. And when you can start benchmarking yourself against your competition based on a common framework, then you're just going to want to get better and better. And then that's better and better for the place you're in anyway, because you're driving social value, which is surely the point of the whole initiative in the first place.
So does that mean that an SME is competing on level terms with a tier one contractor? That if everything's judged according to the specific criteria of that locality and that contract, then they're both in with an equal chance?
So if they're bidding for a £100,000 groundworks contract, say, then it's £100,000 worth of work. Now, the price might vary slightly and the quality would vary slightly, which are, of course, the traditional ways of scoring. But the social value contribution in that £100,000 has to operate within the constraints of that box. So you couldn't have a big tier one contractor coming in and saying, we employ 50 apprentices nationally. Well, that doesn't count, because those 50, maybe only two of them are going to work on that site. So it does bring it down to a level playing field, I think, in most cases. And very often, a local company is going to be better tuned into the local needs and will already be doing certain things to support that local community than maybe a big multinational or a big national company.
But the tier ones have got whole departments now of marketing people whose raison d'etre is to promote and shout about their social value. Whereas your local groundworks contractor hasn't even got an HR department, never mind a marketing department. It's the boss's secretary does it all kind of thing. I mean, it's a different type of organisation, and it can't begin to compete with the sophisticated industry that you're part of, the social value industry, which is funded by the tier one contractors. I think it's unleveled the playing field. It's made it worse, hasn't it?
Well, I don't think it's about marketing. It's just about what you're going to contribute in that contract. So you can shout about it. I mean, many a big organisation, for example, will have, and I used to work at Vodafone years ago, and Vodafone have a global foundation that does good around the world. Fantastic, fantastic. But if they're going to bid on the, a piece of working or a contract for the local authority in Norwich, then that has no value locally. So it's got to be tuned in to the project that they're working on. And that's where I think it levels it out, because it's within the constraints of that box of that project.
If you're advising Rees-Mogg, what would you tell him if he wants to make it simpler, more about value for money, and level it back towards SMEs as the original legislation intended? What improvements could be made, or do you think it's perfect?
It's never going to be perfect. This is a brand new industry that's emerging, and a brand new demand. And I can draw a parallel to how we perhaps thought of health and safety 30 years ago, compared to how we feel about health and safety today. Health and safety today is an absolute given. There are experts, there's the law to protect everybody. And I see social value in the future having a similar sort of status, but there are not so many experts around at social value today. We all can have a view. And we find that we're doing an enormous amount when we're talking to any prospective new member. A lot of our conversation with them is about education, because many of you think social value, we need to do a bit of measurement. Who can do that? We don't have a clue. We'll pick one. Oh, we're measuring social value. But they're not necessarily doing it in the best way for them and on the most level playing field. My advice to him would be to look a little bit closer. And I think he would see, certainly from what we're doing, but also our peers in the industry, of making social value more available. I know the Sustainability School are looking at broadening their training modules around social value, which of course is a free training service. We'll be announcing some things at our conference at the end of April that will help SMEs get access to it more easily and become more visible. And I think it's a short-sighted view for him to say it's not helping SMEs as a broad brush comment. We certainly don't pick and choose. And we're getting interest across all sectors, not just the construction industry, but telecommunications, IT, other services. Even organisations that are not necessarily looking to win work from the government, we're getting organisations that just want to improve their own brand positioning, to be more appealing to employees for staff retention, just to be doing the right things. So it's not just the big tier one contractors that are sort of stealing a march. That's not happening at all.
It sounds like everything you're suggesting is going to increase bureaucracy for the small man rather than reduce it, though, to me.
Well, you can look at the TOM, you can look at the TOMs, and you can look at the other frameworks, and you can say, yes, this is a beast of a thing. And if you take every single measure and you really want to understand every single measure in its entirety, yeah, you can almost do an O-level on it. But the reality is that you don't need to. You can just pick on the things that you're doing today and improve on them, and just pick on some of the themes that are relevant to your area. Because some of them won't be, and there's no point in pledging a social value that's of no interest to your local area or the area in which the project is running. The portal makes it really simple. It's simple to upload stuff. We check it. We provide nice reports. So do our competitors. And so it's really designed to make it easy. So I would challenge that it's making more bureaucracy.
Is there a question of awareness amongst SMEs? I mean, are they just not quite as clued up when it comes to social value compared to the larger companies? I mean, might they be missing out there simply because they've got other things occupying their minds and they haven't got the focus that maybe a larger company would have on this?
Possibly, but I think where they start to notice it is where they get these RFPs or these ITTs and there's a section about social value embedded into it. So they're forced to work out what it is. And so I think the awareness is probably a bit higher. I think at this point, a lot of them are thinking, well, I just need to be able to fill in this question.
Yeah.
And they fill in, they submit it, and either they win the bid or they don't win the bid. But really, it's about continual improvement and understanding how they move things forward. Going back to my health and safety example, it would be very different 30 years ago to how they would deal with health and safety now. But it's, you know, it's really important that this social value is embedded in our society. I think we can all see that. And our aim is to try and make it as simple as possible. And by turning it into a monetary contribution, a percentage contribution of the contract value, really gives it something solid to base it on.
Why not just give the money to a hospice?
Well, hospice might not be needed. Who knows if a hospice is needed in that particular place? Homelessness might be more important. There's a whole raft of things.
But a specific charitable good cause rather than some nebulous theme that someone's invented.
No, they could absolutely contribute to a charity. I mean, we're starting to partner with organisations that are matching charities to local needs. But yeah, I mean, some people will say, well, we put money in the Alzheimer's Society, for example, or cancer research. And these are fantastic charities.
Or whatever charity the local councillor happens to prefer at the moment.
So cynical.
Well, that's my problem, you see. It's open to cynicism, because if the local councillor is chairman of the local dogs trust, and you'll say, oh, well, we'll chuck 10 grand to the local dogs trust. I mean, there's a problem there, isn't there?
Yeah, that doesn't really happen, though. That doesn't really happen. I think there's the Toms will put a weighting against the charitable donation that's relative to that place. We're embarking on a project in Durham right now to encompass a whole range of influential organisations, including the university, the local council, the police force, the fire service, private industry, as a collection of maybe 15 powerful bodies in that place who are working out what the ideal social value is going to be for that place, and get everybody as a place-based strategy to contribute into what's important. And that's the real thing. We run local needs analysis using public information, but we produce a nice report for somebody that says, this is the place you're going to build this thing, the 25-mile radius of it. This is what's needed here. When you go to your ITT, you should be asking for social value, particularly in these areas, because that's what's important.
It's an even bigger monster than I realised.
But it's driving. We've had something like 15 billion pledged through our portal. And I've just got some numbers here that might be interesting. 227,000 hours of volunteering, 6 billion of local spend in the community, 65,000 jobs created or sustained, 28 million spent with SMEs. There's loads of great numbers hanging off the back of this. That's what
I would love that so much more if I didn't feel like behind it was some boss going, oi, you've got to go spend your weekend helping the scouts or we don't get that contract. I mean, you know, it doesn't feel like proper giving to me. It feels like compulsory giving, which is not the same thing.
Yeah, it's a fair point. It's a cultural thing. You want people to be forced into doing it. I mean, but doing things for commercial gain is what drives businesses, and that's actually then driving good. So if the scouts need helping, then that's not a bad thing, is it?
I can't argue with that.
No.
If the end of the day, good gets done, I can't argue with it. You know, we all like good things being done. My head's exploding. The scope, the way this industry is mushrooming up. Who can be the goodest giver?
I think going back to the point of Smees, though, I think the advice of Smees would be just pick a couple of things that you're already doing and do them a bit better. Don't think of it as a vast beast. Think of it as a huge menu of great things you could be doing for your community that's going to help you be more successful in business. And that's a great feeling.
It makes me wonder, Phil, this is addressed to Phil, if you would have been saying the same thing about health and safety sort of 40 or 50 years ago, you know, when it was like the Health and Safety Commission started up. You know, this is all the whole industry built, you know, growing up around health and safety. Just get on with a job and make sure you don't hurt yourself.
I tell you why I don't hold that analogy perfectly. I mean, I take your point about it's an industry being created. But the health and safety industry was not about, was about construction workers themselves. Mm-hmm. It's in the vested interest of the construction company to keep its employees alive, fit, healthy and at work. Because if they're not at work the next day, you've got to train someone else up, find someone else. And, you know, leaving aside the court cases and the litigation and anything like that, just the sheer bottom line vested interest. It's in the vested interest of the construction company to observe health and safety.
Yeah.
Whereas what we're talking about with social value is the wider societal interest, which, if anything, I'm more interested in because I'm part of a wider society. I don't work on a construction site. So, you know, for me, frankly, it doesn't really matter to me personally whether you kill your employees on construction sites. And I'd much rather you spend your money, you know, planting daffodils on the roundabout in the middle of Maidstone Town Centre to make it look nice, because that touches my life personally. But objectively, what do I think is more important? Saving lives.
I think both are very important, because driving social value kind of saves lives a bit as well, doesn't it? It makes lives better, better communities, just lots more feel good.
Well, Andrew, I don't mean to have given you a hard time. I apologise, but you put the side of the story very well. And I know that I'm on the wrong side of history here. And I know that your industry is going to go from health to health. So good luck.
Thank you very much, guys, for having me. Much appreciated the time.
Well, thanks for joining us, Andrew. Thanks a lot. Well, I don't know if that answered your questions, Phil. It sounds to me like you still have quite a few more, but I'm sure we'll come back to this.
It's clearly a beast with big legs, is social value. It's going to grow and grow.
Yeah, indeed. Well, look, let's move on a bit. I want to plug the magazine now, because the magazine is out.
I want to ask you about the magazine. It's lots of scaffolding.
There's lots of scaffolding in it. Scaffolding and access is the main feature, I suppose, of this one. We've got lots of other things in there as well. But, yeah, scaffolding and access, there's got three pieces on that, basically. SGB, or other, as they now like to be known, Linden SGB, is on a massive project in Manchester. They're scaffolding, well, they've scaffolded the whole of Manchester Town Hall, which is this big big Victorian edifice.
I thought SGB was the name of Rick's hamster in The Young Ones.
No, that was SPG.
Oh, that was it.
Wasn't it? SPG. No, SGB, Scaffolding Great Britain. Of course, it's an interesting...
Not Special Patrol Group.
No, certainly not. No, SGB, it's strange because, I mean, SGB is basically the world's biggest scaffolding company. I mean, they manufacture scaffolding, they're a contractor, they're a supplier, all the rest of it. They do everything, and all over the world as well. But they've had a very checkered history recently. They were losing a lot of money. They were bought out by... Is it Harsco, the American company that bought them out?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they were part of Molem, last I knew.
That's right.
Molem
became
part of Carillion, didn't they? But SGB were well out of it before Carillion was involved.
Yeah.
But are they not? They're not Harsco anymore, then?
Well, they're owned by something that calls itself Brand Safway, and I'm pronouncing that the way it's written. I think they probably call it Brand Safeway, but they can't spell Safeway. They're American-owned, basically. They've recently bought out Linden Scaffolding, which is another quite large scaffolding company, but nowhere near as large as SGB. Nothing is as large as SGB. And also...
Linden with a Y, isn't it? Not Linden Command Satarica.
No, nothing to do with them. Lyndon, Linden SGB, they now are. And I think with Linden came Taylor's Hoists, which is, as the name suggests, hires out materials hoists and I think also passenger hoists as well. And so they're working. They've got all their equipment on Manchester Town Hall. Some fantastic photographs, actually. The photographs are the best bit. It's an amazing building. I don't know Manchester particularly well. Manchester Town Hall is this big Victorian edifice, which has got several courtyards, loads of towers, and loads of terracotta detailing. It's a fascinating building. Anyway, they've got, I think it's something like 37,000 tons of scaffolding on this building at the moment. So quite an interesting job there. And I also spoke to their new managing director, a chap called Stuart Robinson, who actually, and the timing is all a bit interesting here, because Linden, I'm trying to get the timing right. It all happened in very quick succession. They got the job. Lendlease is the main contractor on this refurbishment of the town hall. Linden SGB got the job, in early 2019, I think. And somewhere between there, that happening and arriving on site, SGB took over Linden. So I don't know whether SGB had the job and then they took over Linden, or whether Linden had the job and then they were taken over by SGB. And then about a year later, they had a new managing director arrive. So Stuart Robinson sort of parachuted in while the job was already underway. And he's an interesting character because he doesn't come from the sort of site services or scaffolding side of the industry. He was previously with Mace. He's done a lot of international work, sort of engineering and building. He was with Mace for, I think, 15 years before he joined. So he's got quite a different background for somebody running a scaffolding company now. So, so that's interesting job, quite an interesting company as well. What else have we got in the magazine?
You said the pictures are the best thing about this feature. I mean, they are good pictures, but your words are pretty fantastic.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you, Phil. I would have liked to have delved a little deeper, but SGB isn't the most forthcoming organisation, big corporate company. I would have liked to have found out a little bit more about the timeline on this job, because I think that was probably quite an interesting factor. But I think it's still quite a good feature, though I say so myself.
you've also got a feature, I noticed, on an organisation called Hypertunnel, which I've done a couple of bits and bobs on online news service over the past, 6 months or so.
Yeah.
And I hate talking about people as anyone who claims to be a disruptor.
Yes.
I think I've said before, yeah. they need shooting. But if these people are for real, I mean, they actually could be, they could lay claim to the term disruptor.
Yeah.
Then they're not tunnellers, and they reckon that people who do know tunnelling have been doing it wrong all these years. They know nothing about it. Come along and go, we've got a much better idea for digging tunnels.
Yeah.
And we're going to show you how. And they appear to be making friends and influencing people.
Yeah, well, this is the strangest thing. It was following on from the articles which you'd actually posted online that made me want to have a word with these people. Yeah, the strangest thing about it is that they seem to have won over a lot of very influential people in the tunnelling industry. I mean, here, as you say, they claim to be disruptors. And actually, I'm not sure they use that term, but they certainly fit the description. If you think about tunnelling as basically boring through the earth with a great big tunnel boring machine, which is what we normally think of it as, it's completely different. What they use is directional drilling to sort of stitch out the profile of a tunnel by lots and lots of parallel directional drilling holes, and then send these robotic devices down these holes to inject, some sort of cement or something like that. And then they break out the earth inside that tunnel, and they scoop it all out. I'm not describing it very well, but it is a completely different approach. It's very much to do with artificial intelligence, swarm technology, which of course is really cutting edge, and we usually think about that in terms of drones. You've probably seen the YouTube videos of swarms of drones doing terrifying things, usually in a military context. But they're talking about these bots which go down these holes which they've drilled and doing all sorts of clever stuff. It's cheaper, there are fewer people required, you don't have to go down the hole yourself. And they've come up with this idea, two guys actually who I think were in the energy business. They were talking about, they were trying to, what were their names? Let me see. Steve Jordan and Jeremy Hammond, two guys who, entrepreneurs, not engineers, who have a background in sort of renewable energy. They were looking into tidal energy particularly, and they realized that if you could drill, tunnel into the ground, into the shoreline, you could actually sort of get tides to flow in and out of these tunnels and generate electricity that way. I don't know whether they're actually doing that, but when they looked at the economics of it, they found that, no, it's far too expensive. You couldn't do this because tunnelling is a really expensive way of achieving this. So they went away and came up with this idea of doing it, what they reckon is cheaper. I don't know. It does sound too good to be true in many ways, but they've got lots of people, really sort of people in the British Tunnelling Association. I've got, in fact, I did a little box out with a list of the great and good, some of the people who are involved.
Includes our friend Dr. Benoit Jones.
Yes, indeed, who was on the podcast a few months ago. Yeah, Benoit Jones, Managing Director of InBuy Engineering, the chairman of this organisation, Hypertunnel, is Peter O'Riordan, who's former engineering lead at Crossrail. So, he knows a thing or two about tunnelling. Other people, people from Vinci Construction, several people from...
Bauer, Jacob, Stantec. Yeah. These are proper people, proper tunnelling people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they know...
And that's what gives them their credibility. If I hadn't seen this list of people who said, we're interested in this, we'll help you make this come to fruition, I would have just written it off as interesting idea, go away.
All this was sort of worked out sort of academically, this is all like a big idea, but they have been doing site trials. They're going to do they're planning to do a big trial towards the end of this year. I don't know exactly where or what they'll be doing, but they're going to, trial it, full size within a year. So that, I think that will be a real milestone for them. That will, if they manage to prove it in real terms, then I think people have to start taking them seriously.
It does sound to me a little bit like one of these enterprises where the person who starts it doesn't make any money from it. Then someone else will come along and try and get it going, and they don't make it work, and they don't make money from it either. And it'll be the third person that gets hold of this idea, this business, that actually starts making money. Sometimes these sort of high-risk, long-term, long-gestation startups, it's not the original innovator that gets rich from it, is it?
No, that's true. Don't tell them that. Although I have to say that, Jeremy Hammond and Steve Jordan have stepped away, I think is the phrase. They've, they've done their bit. They came up with the idea. I think they're still involved, but they're not in executive roles now. They've handed it over to a management team who are taking it forward. I mean, they've been very clever about it. They've set up a technical board. They've got these big people on board. So if you like, the engineering is in safe hands. They've come up with the concept. They've convinced these eminent engineers that there's something to go on here. And then they've handed it over to their technical board who are taking it forward. So yeah, I've got a timeline here. September 2021, they exhibited at the British Tunnelling Society's conference and exhibition. That was last year. And that's really when we found out about it. But towards the end of this year, they'll be doing a full-scale trial somewhere. So, it's worth keeping an eye on.
Excellent. So that's the magazine, the latest issue of the magazine, which is the March 2022 issue. Where can people get hold of it, David?
Where can you get hold of it? You can buy a copy online if you go to www. We don't say that anymore, do we? theconstructionindex.co.uk.
Only you, McGran.
Yeah, you can order it online. Go to our website, order it online, and I think it's still £5 per issue.
Bargain.
I don't personally sell them. I just edit it. But yeah, you can get hold of that, or you can buy a subscription, which is even better.
Great. I think we've put in a shift this morning, haven't we?
We certainly have. Yeah. I mean, I could carry on talking about the magazine, but I'm not going to. There are lots of other things in there. We've got a bit about archaeology, which is my favourite feature in this issue, actually, because I thought there was a fascinating thing. So
we wanted to get an archaeologist on the podcast to talk about it. We couldn't dig one up, could we?
No, we couldn't. We couldn't get the one we wanted, put it that way. And by the time it came around to recording the podcast, that it was too late. But no, it'd be nice to maybe later on. I mean, they're digging things up on HS2 all the time. And in fact, this is one of the most interesting things about HS2, as far as I'm concerned. They found big Roman settlements and medieval towns and things like this, and all sorts of lovely stuff coming to the surface. So maybe when there's another big discovery, we'll be able to get somebody on to talk about it.
We'll return to that. I agree. I think archaeology is, particularly its intersection with construction, is interesting on many levels.
It is, definitely. Yeah. So, are we done?
I think we are. Thank you once again to our guest, Andrew Lowe, from the Social Value Portal. But from him, David Taylor, and me, Phil Bishop, another week over. Thank you very much for listening to us. And next week, we will probably be talking about whatever it is that Rishi Sunak said today.
Yeah.
So, goodbye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.